In verses 1 and 2, Jesus predicted the destruction of the temple. We know that happened in 70 AD. In verse 3, they asked him, tell us, when will these things be? These things, referring to what he had just predicted, the destruction of the temple. And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now, this last line, we'll look at more carefully when we study the Olivet Discourse, and we'll do that before very long now. But let me just say this. Some believe there are two questions here. About two periods of time. One about 70 AD, when shall these things be that Jesus has just predicted, which was fulfilled in 70 AD, and what should be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And that second question would have to do with the end times. Those who understand this way suggest that part of Matthew 24 is about 70 AD, and part of it's about the end times. And the question then becomes, which part is about which? Now, there's another way of looking at it, but we'll just not get into all the views of Matthew 24 yet. Let me just point this out. The question was asked upon the occasion that Jesus predicted the destruction of Jerusalem. The question was asked because of curiosity about when Jerusalem would be destroyed and what signs there might be preceding this. If the disciples also were asking about the end times, that's a secondary consideration. And it may well be that Jesus answers both questions and talks about both subjects. But which part of the question is answered in Matthew 24:21? Then shall be great tribulation. Which part? Is that about 70 AD, which is what essentially occasioned the question, or about the end times? Well, as we look at the parallel to this, which is indeed a parallel, and we will show this when we compare Mark 13, Luke 21, and Matthew 24 at a later date. In Luke 21, we have the parallel statement to this. It falls in exactly the same place in the discourse as Matthew 24, 21 does. If you follow point by point through Luke 21 and Matthew 24, you'll find the thoughts are thought for thought the same right up until this point, and including at this point. But in Luke 21, 20, it says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. And let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Now, remember earlier in this, look at the disciples' question as put in Luke 21. I don't want to steal too much time from Daniel, but this is significant. In Luke 21, verses 5 and 6, we see Jesus predicting not one stone will be left on another. The same thing he predicted in the first two verses of Matthew 24. On the same occasion, as he walked out of the temple for the last time before his crucifixion. Luke 21, 5 and 6, he makes the prediction. Luke 21, verse 7 has their question. Now this, Luke 21, 7 is parallel to the question of the disciples we saw in Matthew 24, verse 3. What does it say in Luke, though? They asked him, saying, teacher, when will these things be? That is the destruction of the temple, just mentioned in the previous verse. And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place? Now, notice that Luke, and by the way, if you check Mark 13, it'll be the same. Mark and Luke are precisely the same on this point. Matthew is the only one that differs. But in Mark and Luke, the question of the disciples doesn't even extend to the question of the end times. Both questions are about these things that Jesus has just commented on, right? Not one stone to be left on another. Oh, when will these things be, and what will the sign that these things are about to happen? There are indeed two questions, but they both have to do with the same thing. These things, the destruction of Jerusalem, he's just predicted. One is, when will it be, in terms of chronology? Secondly, what signs will there be to tell us that these things are about to happen? Well, as part of Jesus' answer, he says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then you'll know that its desolation is near. Obviously, he had predicted its desolation in verses 5 and 6. They said, when will it be and what sign will there be? And he says, well, one sign will be Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies. And then you'll know it's near. You'll know it's about to take place, the very question they asked in verse 7. So, I mean, reasonably, unless we want to import all kinds of things that are not necessary or found in the text, Jesus, in verse 20 of Luke 21, is talking about 70 AD, the Romans besieging Jerusalem, and its desolation being near at that point, and of course it came. But that is parallel in the passage to Matthew 24, verse 21, when, you know, then will be great tribulation. Now, unless we want to have Jesus give two Olivet discourses on identical circumstances, in identical situations, which I don't know anyone who's willing to do, we have to say that Luke 21 and Matthew 24 are parallel. And although they put Jesus' statements in different words from each other, they in some cases simply clarify what he said over what, you know, one author might give his exact words and the other author give basically a clarification of what he meant. When Jesus said there would be great tribulation, Luke said that's the time of great distress on the land, which would happen when they see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. He's talking about 70 AD. How could it be taken otherwise? If we're going to take the context into consideration. Okay, another consideration, of course, is that Matthew 24, after he made this prediction, he said in verse 34, "Surely I say to you, all this generation will by no means pass away till all these things." The very things they asked about. When will these things be? Well, this generation won't vanish before these things have all taken place. So we've got the "these things." When will these things be? What, the destruction of Jerusalem? Well, this generation won't pass before these things are fulfilled. He seems to be answering their question about 70 AD, about the destruction of Jerusalem. It happened within that generation. It's really, I mean, unless one brings an agenda to read something else into it, Jesus made kind of plain statements about this. So it appears to me that this great tribulation of which Jesus talked about was the Jewish war and the siege of Jerusalem, which culminated in its desolation. And I believe Daniel 12:1 is talking about the same thing when it says, "There shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time." Sounds like Daniel and Jesus talking almost exactly the same terms about the same event. Now, I would point out to you, as this is, doesn't carry anywhere near as much weight as the cross-referencing of Scripture does, but just as a corollary to this, Josephus, as we shall find when we study this more carefully, it'll be on a Friday night, Josephus actually, without being aware of these passages, said, as he described what happened to Jerusalem, he says, "In my opinion, there's never been a city in history that has suffered such horrible things as the Jews have in this situation." I mean, now, Josephus may not have known of every case, but he's a historian, and he knew of no case in history where any city suffered as greatly as Jerusalem did at that time. Sounds an awful lot like what Jesus said would be the case. And when people read the works of Josephus in detail, one could easily believe it. I mean, it's hard to imagine any city in history experiencing quite such a horrendous time of trial as Jerusalem did during that time. Some historical event has to be the worst, and we know of none worse than that. And so, in my opinion, that is what is in view in Daniel 12. Okay? Now, in the second part of verse 1, Daniel 12:1, second part it says, "At that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book." Daniel's people would not necessarily be the whole nation of Israel, but he was a representative of the believing remnant of Israel. The believing remnant of Israel were an entity, in God's eyes, an entity unto themselves. We know this from reading the prophets, the other prophets in this Old Testament. God always makes a distinction between the believing remnant as a class of people and those who were the people of his curse, who were Jewish but still cursed because of their disobedience and rebellion. Daniel certainly belonged to that class, which we call the believing remnant of Israel. And when the messenger says to him, "At that time your people shall be delivered, Daniel," the people of the group that you belong to, it would mean the believing remnant. Of course, in 70 AD, that was the Jews who had become Christians. And they were delivered. They escaped. History tells us that. And it's clarified, "everyone who is found written in the book." Now, that statement is perhaps very significant, because in Luke 10 and verse 20, Jesus was talking to his disciples, who were of that believing remnant in his day. And Jesus said to them in Luke 10 and verse 20, "Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rather rejoice because your names are written in heaven." Now, were the Pharisees' names written in heaven? Obviously not. But the disciples, the believing remnant, their names were written in heaven. Now, when Daniel is told, "Your people will be delivered, everyone who's found written in the book," it means not every Jew, but every Jew whose name is written in the book. Jesus already told his disciples, we know, that his disciples' names were written in the book, but not all the Jews were. The ones who would be delivered, therefore, are the believers among the Jews, not all the Jews. This was, in fact, a time of great trouble on the Jews, such as none before, a great time of judgment and vengeance of God upon them for killing the Messiah. But those who were written in the book, that remnant, would be delivered. They were. Okay, we don't need to look for a future fulfillment of this simply because it's already happened, exactly as he said. Now, we know too, let me just suggest to you, there is a possibility, and I think it likely myself, that these last lines of verse 1 summarize the whole process of God saving the remnant of Israel and Gentiles who are written in the book through the whole time of the church history, and it jumps to now. You know, I mean, it summarizes that. It jumps to the end of time. One reason I think that is because Luke 21 does something like that, in my opinion. I say my opinion because there's a lot of ways to understand Luke 21, but I think that Luke 21 does that. If you look there again, notice, in talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, Jesus says in verse 22 and following, Luke 21, verse 22 and following, "For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled." This may even suggest that Daniel's prophecies were fulfilled then, for the most part. I mean, with the exception of a verse or two here or there. "But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword. They will be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And there will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars on the earth," and so forth. "Men's hearts failing for fear." Verse 27, "They'll see the Son of Man coming with the cloud and power and great glory," and so forth. Now, most people, I'm not 100% convinced of this myself, but I'm willing to consider it. Most people think verses 25 through 28 are the second coming of Christ, right? I'll bet you think that. It's probable. And yet, we have 70 AD in verse 20 and through 23. But when it says in verse 24, "They'll fall by the edge of the sword," that happened in 70 AD. "They were led away captive in all nations," that happened in 70 AD. But the last line of verse 24 encompasses the whole church age. The Jerusalem will be trampled by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. That is, until the end of the church age. From 70 AD until the very end, till Jesus comes back, Jerusalem has been trampled by the Gentiles. So we have a jump here, a summary from the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD to the end of time in a single phrase. Summarized, the time of the Gentiles. Well, to my mind, Daniel could as easily be doing that. There's this great time of tribulation, 70 AD. Then there's the deliverance of the remnant and of God, all who are written in the book. That's happening ever since 70 AD. And then we come in verse 2, Daniel 12:2, to the second coming of Christ and the resurrection. That, as I said, is my understanding of it, but there are some other possibilities. Even if 70 AD is in view in verse 1, verse 2, some have felt, let me put it this way, some have felt, and I could see this too as a possibility, that 70 AD is all that is in view in verse 1. That it doesn't encompass the whole church age, and verse 2 doesn't talk about the second coming of Christ, but something else associated with 70 AD. "That many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." Now, if this "those who sleep in the dust of the earth" waking up is not seen as literal, then what might it mean? Well, there might be a wide variety of possible meanings. We know that more than one symbolic use of resurrection is used in the Bible. I already mentioned that in Ezekiel 37, the restoration of the nation of the Jews was likened to a great resurrection of dry bones reassembling themselves into living persons. That represented the restoration of the nation from Babylon. In the New Testament, there's a spiritual resurrection spoken of. We were dead in trespasses, we've been made alive in Christ. That's another use of the imagery. How many uses of the imagery are available? I don't know. One could conceivably argue, and I want to emphasize, this is not my opinion. I don't consider this to be the best possible interpretation. But one could conceivably argue that those who sleep in the dust shall awake refers to people coming to becoming alert, people who were sluggish, inattentive, people who were asleep, as we'd say. We sometimes talk about church being asleep, or people being asleep, and it's a wake-up call when something alerts them to impending crisis or whatever. It is not out of the question to consider that those who sleep in the dust rising, some to everlasting life, some to shame and contempt, could mean that Jesus, through his ministry and the apostolic ministry in the book of Acts and the fall of Jerusalem, all of these things are like a wake-up call. And many people will realize for the first time that they've been asleep. Some of them will respond by getting saved and coming to Christ. The rest will find themselves awakened too late and will simply be destroyed in the Holocaust. Chad? Well, okay, are you suggesting maybe that some who rose might be those in Matthew 27 who came alive when Jesus came alive from the grave? I mean, is that one thing you're leading up to? Okay, 28, I thought it was 27. Yeah. When Jesus rose from the dead, according to Matthew 28:52, many of those who were in the graves in Jerusalem actually came out. But it only mentions the saints there. It doesn't here mention any of those who arose to everlasting shame and contempt. I've thought of that before, but it doesn't strike me, the way it's worded in Daniel doesn't strike me as that being the likely fulfillment, just because that's kind of one-sided there. Only the saints came out in that case, whereas here it seems to speak of both kinds of people waking up. Now, if this latter point were the view, if the rising and waking up and, some awake to salvation, some awake to basically shame and destruction, if that is seen more figuratively and applied to the period from the time of Christ to the destruction of Jerusalem, that some of the Jews will get saved. Some will awaken from their stupor, spiritual stupor, and get saved. Some will awaken only too late and realize that they're facing eternal judgment, their death and their damnation. That is possible, in which case, if that view were taken, verse 3, those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many righteous like the stars forever, would be the ongoing evangelistic efforts of the church after 70 AD. Those who were wise enough to get saved, Jesus said at the end of his Sermon on the Mount, those who hear my words and do them, I'll liken to a wise man who builds his house on a rock. Those who hear my words and don't do them will be a foolish man who builds his house on sand. Those who obeyed Jesus, those Jews who sided with Christ, they're the wise, and they become lights to the world. Jesus said to his disciples, you're the light of the world. They're like the stars in the sky, which are given for light. They're signs and seasons. They are there to communicate. Those who turn many to righteousness will shine brightly. The idea being that verse 3 then would be about the church age, about the career of the church, of the remnant who are saved, and of course the Gentiles who join them, who become lights to the world, like the stars in the heavens are lights to the world. Now, these are two very, very different possibilities, okay? I'm pretty solid in my belief about verse 1. Verses 2 and 3, I can see either way, but I incline toward a more conventional way of understanding verses 2 and 3 for reasons I'll give in a moment. But on the one view, verses 2 and 3 could be more or less spiritualized. People spiritually kind of wake up or they become alert. Many of them are destroyed. Others become saved. And after that, the ones who were wise, the ones who were saved, they become lights to other people, lights to the world, communicators of the gospel through the church age, so that verse 3 would be essentially the church age. It would be very figurative, but Jesus used it figurative. He said, you're the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. That's figurative. When Jesus said, I am the light of the world, that was figurative too. And to say that those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, like the stars. What are the stars but lights to the world, according to Genesis 1:14, to give light on the earth they were made. So there is that possible interpretation. But the other view would be, of course, that the church age is encompassed in the final words of verse 1. And verses 2 and 3 are really about the culmination of all things at the second coming of Christ. In that case, you'd have the actual resurrection of the dead at the coming of Christ in verse 2, and the glorification of the saints in verse 3. And frankly, I think either of those approaches could be true, but probably both are not. I mean, either one or the other, or some other one would be. I don't think it likely that both of these interpretations are true, but it's a little hard to choose between them for me. In any case, either will work. Now, with reference, let's say that verse 2 and 3 is about the second coming of Christ, the resurrection of the dead and the glorification of the saints. There is perhaps some New Testament scriptures to help guide us toward this interpretation. One is that it says in verse 3 that his people will shine like the stars forever and ever. If you'd compare that with the parable of the wheat and the tares found in Matthew chapter 13, in Matthew 13, at the end of the parable of the wheat and the tares, when Jesus, I think he's explaining it here, yeah, in verse 40 and following, he says, "Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and those that practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." Now, since Jesus says this happens at the end of this age, most of us, I think, would apply this to the end times. Jesus is going to send his angels out and weed out the wicked, and then the righteous will shine, just like Daniel said. Now, in all fairness, I should point out to you that there are a few that I've encountered that think even this passage in Matthew 13 is about 70 AD. They feel like the weeding out of the wicked from the kingdom is the destruction of the apostate Jews in 70 AD. And that the shining of the righteous is the righteous remnant become a light to the world for the remainder of the church age. So there's two ways of looking at. When Jesus said it'll be that way at the end of this age, he could mean the Jewish age. He was living in it. He had not yet inaugurated the new age yet of the new covenant. So he could be saying at the end of the Old Testament age. And so there's that possibility as well. I know that some of you are saying, "Boy, Steve, you just make me more confused than I was before." I realize that. And I'm not trying to make you confused. I just want you to be aware, first of all, that there's more than one possibility. I want you to do the sorting out for the rest of your life, or however long it takes you, of what you think the scriptures lean toward here. Remember, you can be undecided without being confused. I consider that confusion is never necessary for a Christian. Confusion is a disordered state of mind. You can say, "Well, I know there's this possibility, I know there's that possibility, maybe I even know of a third or fourth possibility. I haven't decided yet which is the real one, but I don't have to be confused about it. I'll just remain undecided until I have more information. I don't have to let my mind get all tweaked and get confused about it. I can just say, well, there are these possibilities, and I'll just keep them all, in mind until I can decide for sure which is the right one. And maybe, in some cases, we may never know which is the right one until the Lord comes. But this is at least what I'm suggesting to you. Now, another thing is, of course, the resurrection of the dead here. One of the things that's difficult about Daniel 12:2 applied to the physical resurrection at the second coming of Christ is that it says, "Many of those who sleep in the dust shall awake." He doesn't talk about it doesn't sound like he's talking about a total resurrection of all who are in the graves. Now, of course, there are two disagreeable camps about eschatology, about the resurrection. There's the amillennial view and there's the dispensational view. And you'll recall that the amillennial view thinks there's one resurrection where the wicked and the righteous come out of the grave at the same time, what's called a general resurrection. The dispensational view, and by the way, other premillennialists as well, even who are not dispensational, the premillennial view holds there's two different resurrections: a resurrection of the righteous at the coming of the Lord and a resurrection of the unrighteous at the end of the millennium. Now, neither view can be very happy with this verse. On the one hand, in saying many of those who sleep in the dust shall arise, that sounds like only one resurrection. And the dispensationalist can start rubbing his hands saying, "Oh good, here's the resurrection of the righteous, and the rest don't come out yet because they're the unrighteous and they come out later." But the problem with that is, as you read further, it turns out that what he's talking about is some of these many are righteous and some are not righteous. Some of them awake to everlasting life and some to everlasting shame and contempt. So we don't have here a teaching of a resurrection of the righteous on one occasion and a resurrection of the unrighteous on another occasion. Now, if the all-millennialist gets too eager to rub his hands over this thing, saying, here's a proof text for a general resurrection because you got the righteous and the unrighteous there, we got the problem of him saying many of those who sleep shall come forth, rather than saying all will. And this is a bit of a problem to the all-millennial view. Now, of course, if, on the other hand, this isn't even talking about the resurrection of the last day, but it's symbolic of something else, then that might explain why it doesn't fit either view very well of the resurrection. But if we say this is, in fact, the resurrection at the second coming of Christ, it seems to me that the all-millennial view has more in its favor than the dispensational view of two resurrections here. Because many of those who sleep in the dust can mean all. It doesn't sound like it means all, but the word many is the Hebrew word rabim. And there are several times in the Old Testament that this word is used in the sense of essentially all. One, I can't give you all the cases, I have a list of them in my Bible, but I'll give you one example where it would appear to be so. In Isaiah 2, verses 2 and 3. In Isaiah 2, verses 2 and 3, it says, "Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow into it, and many people shall come and say." Notice many. It's the same word, rabim. Many. But it's parallel with all nations in the previous verse. You've got the people who are coming are described as all nations and many people. Now, it could just mean many people who are representatives of all nations, but it sounds like the passage is describing a universal phenomenon. It speaks of many coming there. Let me show you another example here of importance. In Mark 10, this is not rabim, the Hebrew word, but it's another important connection here. Mark 10 and verse 44, or 45, excuse me. Mark 10, 45. Jesus said, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Now, Jesus said he came to give his life a ransom for many. But if you look over at 1 Timothy 2:6, Paul says that Christ gave himself a ransom for all. Now, the Calvinists who believe Jesus didn't die for everybody, they like that statement, he came to give his life a ransom for many, because they say many isn't all. But Paul says Jesus gave his life a ransom for all. Now, how do we join those two concepts? Did he give his life a ransom for all or for many? Both. Both are true. Many doesn't have to be in contrast to all. Many can be in contrast to a few. Okay? Apparently, when it says Jesus gave his life a ransom for many, it doesn't mean not for all, but only for many. What it means is not a few, but many. Happens to be all, because all are many. There are many in what is, we say, all. And this usage of the word many is possible. It's not as natural, but it's possible in Daniel 12:2. Many of those who sleep in the dust could mean all who happen to be many in number will come forth. Now, one thing in favor of this interpretation is that most commentators would agree that Jesus probably had this verse in Daniel in mind when he spoke in John chapter 5, verse 28 and 29 about these things. John 5, 28 and 29, Jesus said, "Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who've done evil to the resurrection of condemnation." Sounds very much like Daniel 12:2. And most commentators seem to think that Jesus is alluding to Daniel 12:2. But notice he says all who are in the graves. And if he is alluding to Daniel 12:2, then he is interpreting Daniel's many to mean all. Now, this is only one of a few possibilities, but it seems to me with this New Testament information in hand, we're probably wisest to understand this to be a prediction of a general resurrection at the second coming of Christ. Okay, now we have to finish up here in only a few minutes some important things. Verse 4, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." Now let me say this. This business of many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall increase has often been pointed out by end time prophecy experts as being fulfilled in our own time. Notice how people run to and fro throughout the earth. We all have frequent flyer miles probably to our name. If not, we at least have cars and we zip, zip, zip around as never in any previous century could people do. Furthermore, knowledge is increased. We live in an age of technological explosive scientific knowledge, and we've got, you know, we've got almost an information glut with the internet and with television and radio and all the information available to us. As no other time in history, knowledge is increasing and running to and fro is increasing. And therefore, they like to say this is clearly the end times because this is what Daniel said would happen. However, it's not necessary to understand this way. Many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall increase is, to my mind, probably in contrast to Amos chapter 8 and verse 11, which said that people would run to and fro seeking the word of the Lord, but would not find it. In Amos chapter 8, verse 11 says, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord God, that I will send famine in the land, not a famine of bread or a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Lord. And they shall wander from sea to sea and from north to east and run, and they shall run to and fro." The very same thing Daniel says they'll do. They'll run to and fro. What are they doing running to and fro? Seeking the word of the Lord, but they shall not find it. Okay? In Amos's day, and sometime he was talking about after that, people were running to and fro to get the word of the Lord, but they couldn't find it because it wasn't available. But this messenger is saying to Daniel, there's a time coming when they will run to and fro, presumably for the same reason, to find the word of the Lord, and they will find it. Knowledge of what is meant here will increase. The time will come when the time is right, the time unto which the book has been sealed. When that time comes, knowledge will increase. Now consider this. I think Amos was predicting the 400 years before Jesus came, the 400 years of silence when God sent no prophets. There was a famine for hearing the word of the Lord during those 400 years. But how did that famine come to an end? With John the Baptist and Jesus preaching and the gospel going out. Therefore, knowledge, the time of running to and fro and not being able to hear the word of the Lord was over when Jesus came and when the apostles went out to all nations and so forth. What I think he's saying is that the condition Amos described will be over when the time comes for the fulfillment of this prophecy. People will run to and fro, and instead of failing to find the word of the Lord, there will be knowledge available. It will, you know, people will increase in their understanding of what God's doing and what his purposes are. The scriptures were written. The New Testament scriptures became available. The preaching of the gospel to all the world certainly has brought an increase of knowledge. Now, verse 5. "Then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two other, one by the this side of the riverbank and the other on the other riverbank. And one said to the man clothed in linen who is above the waters of the river, 'How long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be?' Then I heard the man clothed in linen, who is above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand." Usually you hold up one hand to swear, but this was such a solemn oath, he held up both to heaven. "And he swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time, when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished." Now, the question in verse 6, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? It's not necessarily that he's asking, when will this be? How long till it starts happening? But the fulfillment period. When this begins to be fulfilled, how long will it take to completely fulfill it? How long will be the period of fulfillment? Now, if we understand the Jewish war to be the period of fulfillment, because he says at the end of verse 7, when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things will be finished, then the end of the time, times, and half time is when Jerusalem is destroyed in 70 AD. Well, if time, times, and half time is 3.5 years, as many believe, that's how long the Jewish war was. It began, I think, in June of 66 AD, and it ended, I think it was in September or so, so it wasn't quite 3.5 years, but it was very close to 3.5 years. I may have the months wrong, but it was very, very close to almost exactly 3.5 years, the Jewish war. And therefore, we could say the time of the Jewish war, culminating in the complete shattering of the power of the holy people, was that time of fulfillment that he's describing here. It was 3.5 years long. Now, let's go on. I'm sorry to have to go so quickly over this. "Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, 'My Lord, what shall be the end of these things?'" Now, there's two questions. One has to do with timing. One has to do with what? What shall be the end of these things? And it says, "He said to me, 'Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed and sealed up until the time of the end.' Many shall be purified, made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Now, there's something very helpful in understanding the fulfillment of this particular prophecy. Look over at 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 1. In verses 10 through 12. 1 Peter 1, 10 through 12. This is perhaps the most significant cross-reference of any we've given in this session in understanding the fulfillment of Daniel 12. Peter says, of this salvation, meaning ours, the salvation that has come to us in Christ, the context makes it clear. Of this salvation, the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that would come to you. Here's what they did. They were searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ, who was in them, was indicating when he testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. To them it was revealed that not to themselves, but to us, they were ministering the things which have now been reported to you through those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things which even the angels desire to look into. Oh, man, this is so connected to Daniel 12. It's frustrating to realize I don't have an hour to talk about it. There are so many things here connected to it. You've got the prophets inquiring God what and what manner of time these things are about. There's two questions in Daniel 12. How long and what? Or what and what manner of time? The very two questions in Daniel 12 are the questions Peter says the prophets asked. Furthermore, he says they were told it was not for themselves. It was for who? Us. The church age. People of a later generation than their own. Okay? And that's what we find in Daniel. Daniel asked, we said, hey, go your way, Daniel. The words are closed up and sealed. Now, even when Peter says, even the angels desire to look into it, did you notice it was an angel who asked the question in Daniel 12:6? One said to the man who was clothed in linen, no doubt an angel, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? Even the angels wonder about it. It could be that Daniel had asked that question in 6, but it isn't so. An angel, an angelic being, asked the question in verse 6. Could this be why Peter said, even the angels wonder about this? Now, to my mind, it's incredibly connected. Furthermore, there's two other verses in 1 Peter 1 that connect to this passage. One of them is 1 Peter 1:7. 1 Peter 1:7 says that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And verse 22, 1 Peter 1:22, since you have purified your soul in obeying the truth through the Spirit, in sincere love of the brethren, love one another fervently with a pure heart. Look back now at Daniel 12. Verse 10. Many shall be purified, made white, and refined. Now, is it a coincidence that Daniel makes such a clear reference to, that Peter makes such a clear reference back to Daniel 12 about the prophet asking these things? Oh, by the way, let me just say this. There is no other case in any of the prophets where we read of a prophet asking for more information and being told, no, it's not for your time, it's for a later time. When Peter says the prophets asked this, the only prophet in our Bible that ever asked such a question or was given such an answer was Daniel. There's no other parallel to that. Peter, in making it plural, the prophets probably assumed that if Daniel asked this, probably other prophets asked too. But the only example he knew of, or that we know of, is Daniel. Peter is referring back to Daniel chapter 12. And it says in Daniel 12, many shall be purified and refined. He says, well, we're being refined through our trials. We purified our souls through obedience. The language is so close, so obvious. What I'm getting at here is that Peter is applying Daniel 12 to his own generation. Notice, again, the wording of 1 Peter 1:10. Of this salvation which you have, you, my readers, my contemporary Christian friends, the prophets have inquired about this. Notice it says, in verse 11, it says that when the Holy Spirit through them testified of the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. Did Daniel predict the sufferings of Christ? Yes, in the 70 weeks, the Messiah should be cut off. The glories that follow, what are the glories that follow? the church age. And the, you know, the upshot of the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. And he says the things, here's what's so important. In verse 12 he says, they were told that it was not for them or their generation to know, but who was it for? For us. In other words, the prophecy was sealed up until when? Till our time. Peter's time. The gospel time. Now, Daniel was told that the words were sealed up until the time of the end. Not the end of time, by the way, but the time of the end. Well, the end is an expression used several times in Daniel earlier of the end of the Grecian era, the end of the Roman era, the end of this era, the end of that. It could be the end of the Jewish era. In fact, it almost certainly is, because that's what Daniel 12 predicts, is the destruction of Jerusalem, the end of the Jewish era. And these words are sealed up until that time, the time of the end. The apostles certainly believed they were living in the time of the end. And they were. They were in that final generation before the destruction of Jerusalem. Notice the connection here. Peter indicates that his generation was the generation that these words were sealed up until. Daniel couldn't know it. And no one could know it until the gospel was preached in the time of the apostles. And Peter saw that as the time that the angel referred to. And he said, this is sealed up until the time of the end. Now, Peter at this point doesn't mention the time of the end. But actually, he does. He does in 1 Peter 1 and verse 20. 1 Peter 1:20, he says, Christ indeed was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times. For you, Christ's appearance marked the beginning of the last times, the time of the end. Now, what I'm saying is, Peter is an inspired apostle. I don't care how many teachers disagree with him. I don't care how many church fathers disagree with him. As near as I can tell, Peter understood Daniel chapter 12 as being about the end times, the final era of the Jewish age, culminating in the time when the power of the holy people was completely shattered. Which, according to Daniel 12:7, all these things will be finished. I know. I would also point out to you, although we don't have time to look at it together, that when the angel lifts up his hands and swears by him who lives forever, this is a deliberate echo of Deuteronomy 32, verse 40. You can turn there in your own time. Deuteronomy 32, verse 40. It's the only other place where we find this. In the Old Testament, God lifts his hand up and swears by himself who lives forever. And what is the context? Deuteronomy 32:40 is the prediction of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. You look it up. The judgment of the Jews because of their apostasy. That's what Deuteronomy 32 ends with. And it ends with God raising up his hand, swearing, as I live forever, he says, I'm going to consume them and destroy them. And you could just check that out. Deuteronomy 30, and especially verse 40, it connects with the language of this angel holding up his right hand and his left hand and swearing by him who lives forever. So the language is borrowed from Deuteronomy 32:40, which is a passage about the destruction of Jerusalem. All things considered, I believe Daniel 12 is about the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. Verses 11 and 12 talk about a 1290-day period and a 1335-day period. There's 45 days difference between these. No one knows what this is about. Read all the commentaries you want. No one knows. When it comes to those verses, everyone just falls apart. The most careful commentators, they just go to pieces about these. They all they can do is survey a wide array of possible meanings, but no one has a good idea. Now, I will say that the people who take the most firm stance are the dispensationalists. They think that the 45 days between the 1290 and the 1335 are the length of time it takes to get the judgment underway after Jesus comes back. But that's only a guess, and to my mind it doesn't fit the context at all. What does? I don't know.